From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1854 in a castle. Bank president, court judge, and newspaper reporter Horatio Gates Warner was looking for a place to live, so he decided to build a fortress that would come to be known as Warner Castle. The gray stone building was set amidst a 50-acre farm during the time that he and his family called it home, and now the castle is often surrounded by lilacs. If you didn't know, this imposing structure is located pretty close to your backyard in Highland Park, overlooking Mount Hope Avenue. Now, the castle went through different periods of ownership after it left the Warner family. It was used as a sanitarium, as offices for the City Parks Department, and as the home for the Rochester Civic Garden Center. And while the original building has been remodeled over the past 150 years, its high ceilings, walnut, woodwork, marble floors, and even its grand staircase remain. Preservationists say it contributes to the picturesque quality of the Mount Hope Highland Preservation District. And now, Warner Castle will serve as the new home for the Landmark Society, appropriately so. It was also the site from which the Society announced this year's list that they call Five to Revive, a list of historic buildings and locations that could benefit from investment, maybe from government, from more grassroots activism and strategic revitalization. This hour, we're exploring the five sites on this year's Five to Revive list from the Landmark Society. We'll talk about why they were chosen, and we're going to get an update on some of the progress made with restoring last year's sites to the extent that those sites all are still standing. Not all of them are. It's been a hard year for some. But there's a lot to talk about here, and it's always fun to hear from our listeners as well as you hear the list and you think about if you were thinking about historic sites and structures that stand out in your mind that need a little care and protection. It's a good time to weigh in with that. Let me welcome our guest for the hour. Wayne Goodman is Executive Director of the Landmark Society. Welcome back to the program, Wayne.
Thank you, Evan.
Caitlin Mivas is Preservation Planner for the Society. Welcome back to you.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
Also with us is Bob Seam, who is a board member for Friends of Parrot Hall, which is on this year's list. You're going to learn about that. Bob, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
And Monica McCullough is back with us, who is the president and founder of MM Development Advisors and co-founder of NY Wire, New York Women in Real Estate. Monica, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So we could, in a sense, just go right down the list. But Wayne, why don't you just remind our audience how long you've been doing this with Five to Revive and just the general mission of it.
Sure. So 2013 was our inaugural list of this program. And the program was initiated simply to call attention to historic resources that were ripe for reinvestment. And we often use the term catalytic involvement. So we look for local support in a particular community. We look at the historic significance behind a resource. And then we also look at what catalytic impact would preserving such a resource have on the surrounding neighborhood or village or community.
Okay. And do you have a favorite project in the five? This is the sixth year of it. But in the last 5 years, do you have a favorite one that stands out that says, boy, that's really done well?
Oh, yeah. You're putting me on the spot. I would say probably our biggest success has been the Eastman Dental Dispensary, developed by Home Leasing into housing. Currently, I guess maybe a second, also from Home Leasing, is Holly High School, which was on our inaugural list, and that is preparing to break ground, and construction, I understand, has started. So the reason I mention those as possible favorites is simply because the distance that those resources had to travel to become complete. Those were two structures that were in dire, dire need of preservation. So we're really happy.
Oh, and before we get to this year's list, for people who haven't been to Warner Castle, pretty cool digs. Are you happy there, Caitlin?
Yeah, I think, working in an Olmsted park is probably not too shabby. So I'm looking forward to it.
How much time have you guys spent in there now?
So we haven't moved in yet.
You have moved in, but is this like Ghostbusters where you walked in and Egon's like, I think this place should be condemned. And you're all like, this is great. We'll take it.
No, not at all. Not at all. So we were contacted by Monroe County. Larry Staub, director of parks for Monroe County, contacted us almost a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And I think shared some unpleasant news that the Rochester Civic Garden Center, after occupying the space since 1964, had to dissolve. And it left the castle without a home and without a long-term steward. So over this past year, we've really been working diligently with the county to develop a unique partnership and plan where we hope to move into Warner Castle in the spring. And that will become the fourth headquarters of the Landmark Society.
Very cool stuff. Well, let's look at this year's list here. And I'm going to start on this list with a place in Rochester, a site that has been heavily debated and a lot of, I think, a lot of emotion invested in what's going to happen to the aqueduct. So on your list is Rochester's Aqueduct Reimagined in the city of Rochester. So I'll turn to Wayne and Caitlin for some discussion on why that's on the list, and maybe even more importantly, what it means that it's on the list, because my understanding is it doesn't mean that you are sort of taking sides on what the outcome ought to be at the aqueduct.
Exactly. So this one's maybe a little less obvious and straightforward than some of our other listings where, you know, if it's the Holly High School, that's a building that's in need and you can see it's derelict and needs to be saved and could contribute to the community. With this listing for the reimagining of the aqueduct, it was really spurred by the Rock the Riverway program and funding that's come forward that has huge potential to really invigorate our downtown river corridor. And so obviously the aqueduct is an important part of that puzzle and that whole project. And it's also very complex because it spans two sides of the city and touches all these other really important historic resources, and it itself is a designated city landmark. So the point in including this on the Five to Revive list is to make sure that, you know, the devil's in the details with these kinds of projects. So to make sure that those details are really paid close attention to, and that historic preservation has a voice at the table, and that we can, you know, make sure that we get the best possible project and that it's designed sensitively and, you know, works for the community.
And so I think instead of asking you what do you want to see happen there, maybe it's more appropriate to ask you is what do you think the worst case scenario would be for that site? And I don't mean specific outcomes that are sort of proposed, because I think everybody wants to preserve in some way. But what would be, generally speaking, a bad outcome for a site like that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a part of the city's skyline, right? Especially with the new Frederick Douglass Susan B. Anthony Bridge that we have. This is sort of in the background of that when you look at the classic Rochester downtown skyline. So it's really an iconic resource that the community as a whole, you know, owns. And so I think the worst possible outcome would be something going through that, you know, only a select group of people has approved and vetted. You know, it could be the best design in the world, but if the community hasn't been engaged in the process and hasn't had a chance to have their voice heard, and if all, you know, sides haven't been considered and all possible impacts haven't been considered, I think that, you know, people won't be invested in the change. And, you know, whatever goes there may not be something that, if the community's not invested in it, then it's not something the community's going to use.
Mm-hmm. How do you view this debate that the community's having there, Wayne?
I agree with what Caitlin just mentioned. I think that it's an interesting question. What's the worst case scenario? I guess it would depend on what the community establishes as programmatic goals. So if one programmatic goal would be to increase pedestrian traffic by connecting those two parts of the city, then I think a design needs to reflect those goals. Too often, I think, in our cities, and not just Rochester, but in our cities all across the country, I think we go into these projects quickly, especially if there's funding involved. There's a public outcry to make sure that revitalization occurs quickly and consistently. And in this particular case, that resource is so complicated. For those that may not be aware, so it's like it's the original aqueduct, and then there's a 1922 deck that was put on top of the aqueduct, which is the roadway. When that was added, it really did create a problem for the surrounding buildings, because now the surrounding buildings, RG&E Station 6 comes to mind, it's no longer at grade. There's an appearance that the RG&E station is actually below grade, when in fact it's not. So there's some grade challenges that the city really has to wrestle with, and those are legitimate. And I think that our concern is with the process. We want to make sure that if we have programmatic goals as a city and as a community, the design needs to reflect that, because we get one shot, and we see all over the country urban renewal projects and urban revitalization projects that are well-intentioned, and once they're designed and constructed, we don't see any human beings using them. And it becomes a waste of money, and in some senses, it really sets back the revitalization efforts.
Why? Why do we have well-designed projects that end up with very few people using them?
Well, I think it goes back probably from the urban renewal days in the 60s. You know, Jane Jacobs in New York City used to say that we're building promenades that have no promenaders. And there's a lot of factors that go into that. There's a lot of, depending on location and how you design a space that really speaks to our human interactions. I mean, spaces can be cold and disinviting, and they can also be warm and inviting. So this project is just starting. There hasn't really been design discussions, and that's why we felt like it was timely to include this resource on this list, not to try and point the finger at the city or anyone else. We don't feel like that the resource is endangered, but there's a lot of graffiti art that's also located in the original portion of the aqueduct. Those voices really need to be heard. So it's a complicated discussion. There's going to undoubtedly need to be compromise, and we call for that compromise. But we're looking forward, I think, to representing the preservation voice in that design discussion.
And can I ask, Caitlin, do you view a debate like this as inevitably going to have winners and losers? And I only ask that because I'm thinking of what Wayne just raised, the question with the art. There's some really remarkably good art that has been created there and is sort of considered public space for artists to do that. And then there's some pretty heated emotional debate about whether that it's time to move on from that or whether you can preserve that in some way. Are there inevitably going to be winners and losers?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the sort of the cliche is that, you can't make everyone happy, and mm-hmm. maybe the best compromise is where everyone's a little bit unhappy. But, to your point, the space that's kind of grown up organically in the aqueduct, there was world-renowned artists that, have done work down there, and it's a major attraction for people. I mean, I'm amazed when I meet other nerdy preservationists that are my age from other cities. The first thing they said to me was, oh, Rochester, that's where you have the aqueduct with all the street art. And like, I want to come and see that. And that, I was like, how do you even know about
that? It's known in other cities?
Yeah, apparently. So, yeah, I mean, maybe there's... I don't think it's possible to make everyone happy, but I think as long as there's a chance for everyone to share their vision and their perspective, if people can feel heard and part of the process, maybe we can get to some acceptable resolution.
Okay, fair enough. And do you think, at least because Rock the Riverway has, put this right in its sights as they start to move forward with plans, are you pretty happy that at the very least the decision makers are keeping in mind the value of preservation, that there is a thought that the design should be thoughtful, that we should be incorporating different voices?
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that Rock the Riverway, I think for many years, some folks in the community, maybe rightly so, have been critical in calling attention to the need to connect our resources, particularly downtown. So this is an aggressive approach, and Rock the Riverway seeks to do that, connect all of these interesting resources. So, yeah, we support the project in its entirety. It's just, as Caitlin said, the devil's in the details, and we wanted to get this on the list to make sure that we call that to everyone's attention.
For the last 5 years, the Landmark Society has released their annual Five to Revive list in the fall, and so this is year 6 for them doing that. You can check out past lists and the current on their website, landmarksociety.org. I almost said com. landmarksociety.org. I have no idea what the .com would take you to. But landmarksociety.org if you want to see the list. So there's one, Rochester's Aqueduct Reimagined. Second one I want to talk about is Colgate-Rochester-Crozer Divinity School Campus. Now, it's the whole campus.
Correct. Yes.
I don't know how big of a campus we're talking about, but tell me why it landed on the list. And then I know Monica has a lot to say about that particular project. So.
Yeah, so it's a really important point that it's the whole campus, because the campus as a whole is the historic resource. So it's not just the historic buildings, but the historic designed landscape is an integral part of that property and a part of its historic significance. So we worked with neighbors like Monica last year to help get the campus designated an official City of Rochester landmark, so that any major changes to the property, you know, the property, the buildings are protected from demolition, and any major changes, whether it's new construction or changes in the landscape, have to go before the City of Rochester's Preservation Board. So the landscape is really, it's really easy to look at those fancy architect design buildings and say, oh yeah, those are important, cool historic buildings. But what's a little bit less apparent and obvious is that that landscape is also an important designed resource. So it's not like it's just a hill with some trees on it. It was designed by a very prominent landscape architect from Rochester, Alling DeForest. He also designed the gardens at the George Eastman House. And as the sunken garden behind Warner Castle in Highland Park. So that resource, even though it looks like it's just a natural bucolic setting, that's just as important as the buildings. So we're looking at it as a whole, the buildings and the landscape together as one piece.
All right, so let's stay with the theme then. What's the worst case scenario for what happens at a campus like that?
It's built.
Being built over?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, I think in the same way that the worst case scenario for a historic building is that it's removed.
It's demolished.
The worst case scenario for a historic landscape is that it's removed with buildings.
Okay. And so, Monica, why don't you take me through, as a neighbor of that, how you view that particular piece of property and why you view it in such important terms when it comes to preservation?
Yeah, I think the community that surrounds that area is part of what I call a historic landscape corridor. It includes two Olmsted parks at Genesee Valley and Highland Park. It includes Mount Hope Cemetery. It includes different privately owned resources that are significant in landscape that connect to that property. And it has been an integral part of the community and neighborhood for hundreds of years, and important that it's maintained that way and respected in the future.
Okay. Is there pressure to overdevelop it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's, it's a strong neighborhood. It's a great place to live. There is, in the community, a desire to have more density and create more ability for people to live in that community. I think some of that comes from neighbors and from the community itself of wanting more to support our commercial districts, more to support the amenities that we have. But there's a difference between a piece of vacant property and an architecturally significant designed landscape that frames historic Olmsted Park. They're two different. Each blade of grass is not equivalent.
Okay. And are you hopeful that there's still plenty of time to put this emphasis where it belongs, to make sure that this preservation happens? How far down the road would we be, in other words, to sort of a bad outcome that you would be worried about, Monica?
I think the process is still pretty early on. Okay. The Divinity School still owns that parcel, even though there's conversations of its sale. There is, several different layers of process that have to happen through the city. To define what that site becomes in the future for a new owner. So there's a lot of hope and a lot of excitement, I think, in the community about what that will become. And again, as Wayne said, it's really about the process in making sure that what's significant is respected and preserved.
Okay, so the best case outcome for you is what?
I think there's a lot of different options. The best case option, is a robust process that includes input, and a result that balances the need for change with maintaining what's significant.
Yeah,
to preserve.
We should be clear. It's not that the preservation community or neighbors are opposed to new development on that site, but it needs to be incorporated into the landscape and the existing buildings as sensitively as possible. So there's plenty of room for sensitive development on the top of the hill done strategically. And is so it, I think there's any number of uses that could
correct.
Go there.
It's not a call for something akin to Everwild, et cetera.
That, correct.
That
right.
Some kind of development, as long as it's thoughtful, as long as it doesn't sort of cover over or to kind of destroy the character of what you have there, which is the reason I ask is like, how far along are you toward kind of going down a troubling road? Sometimes the Landmark Society puts something on their 5 to 5 list that's a little bit of a Hail Mary pass. It's a little bit like putting the Titanic on your list after it's hit the iceberg. You're still thinking that this is a great boat and it's worth saving, but the nose of the boat is going up in the air. And that's what happened with the DeMay last year. I don't know if that's a fair, is that a fair analogy? Caitlin Mivas, do you want to remind our audience what happened with the DeMay in Greece?
Maybe in that situation, we put it on the list before it hit the iceberg. I'm not sure.
it was heading toward the iceberg.
Yeah, we could clearly see the iceberg coming, but we just couldn't turn the ship fast enough. The site that the Hotel DeMay was on was owned by a private property owner who wanted to sell it to a developer who was going to put a gas station / convenience store there. And, you know, it was a building that had been vacant for a number of years. And it was really hard for a grassroots local organization did form to try and advocate for it. But it's really hard. You know, you're working behind the eight ball in that instance. And it's hard for you to match the money that a large corporation can put up that's going to build a gas station when they're buying the property. So there was really strong community support, especially in the folks who lived around that site.
Yeah.
Who didn't? There's already problems with traffic there, and they had lots of fond memories of weddings and family gatherings in the former Hotel DeMay, but they didn't win out in that case. It made it through the town approvals, and the sale went through, and they're working through actually the development approvals now.
So it was raised, right?
It was.
When
sadly.
Was it raised?
Late last year or early this year, I think.
I mean,
it was
unfortunately, it was like a few months after it was on your list.
Yeah, so that was only, that's our only
total I actually really admire
loss.
That. No, I really admire that, because you understood the pressure that a project like or a site like that was facing. And it ultimately didn't work out for that site, which, by the way, a lot of people have asked, well, what was going to go to that site? Like a Dunkin' Donuts or something like that? Was that?
Yeah, some kind of gas station.
Gas station Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, combo.
You know, maybe Greece doesn't have any of those. Have you thought about that?
No comment.
Yeah, I was going to say no comment.
Okay. So it doesn't always work out, but the point of what the Landmark Society is trying to do is to identify different sites, historic sites, sometimes buildings, sometimes campuses that need preservation, need emphasis, need grassroots support. And the Hotel DeMay didn't work out. It was demolished. But in many other cases, they've had swells of support, sometimes government support. Sometimes it's kind of a different puzzle. I mean, Wayne, there's not a sort of a simple formula for everything that's on your list here. Sometimes it's, you want to leverage some government support. Sometimes there's not much government support to leverage.
Sure. I mean, one of our more creative listings a couple of years ago was when we listed the traditional trades. And we're still getting, I think, considerable feedback and interest in the trade. So that's a unique example of where it wasn't a tangible building that had a red X painted on it with a demo date in the future. It's something a little bit more intangible. I would point out that with the Divinity School, a strong coalition worked last year, and which included the neighborhoods, the city, the school, and the developer at the time, which was Top Capital. And that proposal was to convert the historic buildings into a boutique hotel event center and to construct some buildings that were newly constructed. And that process created the local designation, but it also created a compromise in which a fairly large parcel of real estate on the top of the hill was actually excluded from the listing. So there's a fairly sizable piece of real estate up on top of the hill behind the historic structures that has been set aside, if you will, or targeted for development. we just feel like that there's a whole multitude of positive outcomes for that property, but we feel fairly strongly that that does not include building all along some of the most important frontage that that sector of the city has.
Steve wants to know if maybe you would put New Era Field on your list. Now, if you heard the discussion last hour, maybe 5 to Revive should include the Buffalo Bills Stadium. If only you could come up with $500 million to renovate that, they wouldn't have to spend $1 billion to build a new one. Have you thought about that one?
If only we had Buffalo in our service area.
Oh, yeah, it's, just out. It's just out. You, in fact, it was a couple years ago that you went pretty far west, all the way down in the range of like either Frewsburg or Cataraugus County.
Cataraugus County. Yeah.
Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, so that if you asked me what my favorite listing was, I was going to say this: it's the Civil War Memorial Building in Cataraugus County in a small town of Little Valley. And it's a building that was built, it's not just a statue, it's an actual building that was built as a memorial to Civil War veterans. And that one's, it's progressed. The county owned it and wanted to demolish it. And now the Friends group that formed, Grassroots Preservation Group, they now have ownership of it. So we're working with them to, you know, make plans and fundraise.
You know, in my former life back in Indiana, outside of Indianapolis, you mentioned New Era Field. The AAA team, the Indianapolis Indians, vacated one of their the old historic ballpark called Busch Stadium, not to be confused with the Busch Stadium in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. But that was actually placed on our state's 10 most endangered list. And finally, there was a redevelopment from a local developer to reuse that, which was a pretty creative reach to reuse an old, dilapidated, vacant baseball stadium. So it's been done, and other communities have sort of saved these historic relics from a bygone era when it comes to the stadiums.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen if New Era, if Buffalo builds a new stadium downtown, what happens there? I'll close the loop on that because enough about the Bills, but I do want to ask, working in preservation, knowing how difficult it is sometimes to leverage support for it, do you view that as a separate conversation, or are you mildly appalled by these kind of conversations about taxpayer support for brand new stadiums for billionaire owners? Caitlin? You're thrilled to be asked that question.
Yeah, I think there's lots of other projects that could potentially, you know, really benefit and have what we talked about, catalytic impact in communities in real need.
Okay. Wayne?
You know, I guess my knee jerk would be to agree with Caitlin's statement. I haven't really given it much thought. I have absolutely no idea how much revenue Western New York derives from it. So I'm really not educated to even make a statement on it.
Oh well, you know,
sorry.
That's such a polite dodge from both of you. I'm going to get a phone call. This is Bonnie in Rochester on line one. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, kind of a two-part question / comment. Does anyone there know, you know, where the dinosaur barbecue place is? Does anybody know what the origins or what the history of that building? Because I know at one point it wasn't used very much, and so it has some kind of history. And the other thing, I really want to ask that question, but the other thing about this is, what do you say about this that monstrosity that they built next to the dinosaur that takes up from Court down to South, most ugly building I've ever seen in my life, cuts off one of the best views of where that same area where you can look at the bridge at night and stuff. I don't know who, except that somebody maybe gave somebody some money or something, because it has pushed that dinosaur to it looks like it doesn't have the same feel to it. But first question, what's the history? And second of all, please tell me, I'd rather hear nobody had any input that knows what they're doing, so I can understand that the stupidity. That building they have there now, that expensive, is deplorable.
So Bonnie, just before you go here, I think what you're describing is the new housing development that is under Bob Morgan's umbrella. Is that correct?
Yes, okay. The FBI guy.
Okay, the FBI guy. Alex Udelson, who's chief of staff for the city of Rochester and Mayor Warren, did say on this program he disagrees with the take that it is disrupting the aesthetics and that he thinks it's going to fit in pretty well.
Does he have eyes?
I appreciate the phone call, Bonnie. Thank you. Caitlin, Wayne, first of all, on the history of dinosaurs, a building, I don't know.
Yeah, so that a few years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, we did a little series called From Eyesore to Opportunity on our website. So if you go to our website and search Eyesore, you can find the story of the dinosaur barbecue building. It was a railroad station depot that was vacant for quite a while. And I believe it was developer Ben Kendig who actually acquired it. And yeah, it was a wreck. And he was one of the first developers in Rochester, if not the first, to really have vision for these dilapidated, vacant, especially industrial structures, to rehab them and put them to productive economic use. So that's a really good early example of adaptive use here in the city. And, you know, as far as the construction next door, you know, new infill is an important part of regenerating our city. And you're always going to have people that... No one's going to be happy. The people, it's a matter of, you know, personal opinion when it comes to the design of buildings.
Okay, Wayne?
Well, and I don't believe that building's, the pure design of the building, I don't believe was really something that's regulated. So it's a developer,
right.
It's privately funded. I would say that it's oftentimes a balancing act that the Landmark Society walks through, so to speak. I think that we want new development, and new development brings more people, and the more people we have, then the more viable our historic resources are. The best way to preserve a historic building is to make sure that it's used and it's loved and it's taken care of. And sometimes you need new development to actually create the vibe and the buzz in order to preserve the old. And so it's a delicate mixture. So I've heard people comment that they love that building. And I've heard, just like Bonnie, people who really, really detest it. So it's
if difficult. If we're not careful, my phones are about to be filled up with people who have opinions on that for the rest of the hour. So I will just say, maybe we'll talk about that at a separate time. Monica, you're a Rochesterian. Have you seen it?
Yeah. I mean, I would, from my perspective, it's kind of the flip side of some of the conversation we have on historic buildings, which is, you know, just because they're beautiful doesn't mean, you know, they need to be saved or they should be saved. And the subjective opinion of a building, whether it's a piece of history or a new piece of future history, is that the design is subjective. So, mm-hmm. You know, as kind of divisive as that may be on a new building, it kind of gets back to, you know, the deeper level of significance of our historic assets, which is beyond just what they look like, because that is subjective. It's a deeper meaning there. And the meaning of this building is still unknown. We won't know it until the future. So there's a judgment there to be reserved.
All right, so I'm late for our only break. Keith, we'll take your phone call when we come back from our break, and then we're going to go back down the list here. We're working our way through the five to revive. It's the Landmark Society's annual list. They choose 5 sites, buildings, etc., all across our region, trying to decide what are the sites that need emphasis, whether it's trying to leverage some government support for preservation or some community grassroots support. That's always welcome. There's some wonderful folks who are always involved with these efforts, and you're meeting some of them this hour. In fact, you just heard Monica McCullough, who's been so involved with what's been going out at the campus of Colgate Divinity and the neighborhood there, and they're on the list this year. Bob Seam is a board member of for Friends of Parrot Hall, which you're going to hear about in just a moment. Caitlin Mivas and Wayne Goodman from the Landmark Society. Let's get that break, and right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the 2018 Upstate Latino Summit comes to Rochester. It's a one-day event featuring influential Latino speakers from across the state. We'll preview it. Then, in our second hour, taking a look at the role photography plays in protest movements. RIT Press has published Whose Streets, Our Streets, and we'll discuss the power of iconic images. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Keith in Farmington next. Go ahead, Keith.
Well, right now I'm really in Greece. when does the Landmark Society, well, she asked where I live, not where I was. when does the Landmark Society consider cost? And what I'd like to touch on is some of the school renovations basically should have been demolished and built rather than remodeled, because it's much more expensive to retrofit an existing building as large as a school than it would be to just knock it down and start all over again. Certain buildings, I say, are worth saving, but some of them, no matter how much they look or how quaint they are, I believe you have to consider the cost and just knock it down and rebuild it.
Caitlin?
Absolutely. To answer the question, how often do we consider cost? Every single second of every single day. That is the number one thing that Wayne and I and our colleagues do. Preservationists are probably the most practical people you will meet. We realize that buildings cannot be saved just for the sake of saving buildings. There has to be an economically viable use. The numbers have to make sense, and you have to have the money to fix them up. Most of the time, rehabbing and investing in an existing building and existing infrastructure is actually more economically efficient than demolishing and building new.
And I think we try to hesitate in getting, while I think that the notion of if it costs more, tear it down seems to be simple on the surface, it's not that easy. What are you tearing down and what do you have after you tear down and rebuild? So if we're going to demolish a building, let's say that has true brick walls, slate roof, marble floors, and we're going to knock that down and replace it with a building that has a 15 to 20 year lifespan, that's not a good investment in the long term. So I think we have to be careful about how we place value and what value means.
I would just say, my guess is, Caitlin, a first year preservationist, in other words, someone who's just kind of getting into it, might have kind of stars in their eyes about this, but like a fifth year or a 10th year has no illusion over what like is realistic.
Yeah, reality hits pretty hard and pretty quickly.
So like if you're like a fifth or a 10th year preservationist, you are super committed because it's not all just saving everything. Sometimes it's losing hard battles and sometimes it's making concessions.
I would think. There are often times where, you know, we say, well, give us 6 months to give it our best. And if we can't make it work, if we can't make a development project work, we can't find a developer who wants to make it work, we say, all right, we did our best. That's the best we can do.
LandmarkSociety.org for the full list of the five to revive. We've talked about the Rochester Aqueduct. We've talked about the Colgate-Rochester Divinity Crozer School campus. Now let's talk about Parrot Hall in the city of Geneva, Ontario County. And I'm gonna bring in Bob Seam to tell us about, because he's a board member with Friends of Parrot Hall. What is Parrot Hall and why is it on this list?
Oh, where to begin? Let's start back in 1856, when it was built as the home for Nehemiah and Louisa Denton. They were very successful agriculturalists at that time, and in the mid-19th century, Geneva was a major center of plant and nursery production, actually, supplying the western movement of the country with fruit trees and other plants. So they built a house, and they after a few years, actually it was more of a colonial brick house. And after a few years, they followed the trend of a book house or a catalog house, where they purchased ornaments for the house from catalogs and books, and attached them to the house and made it an Italianate house with cast iron railings, a veranda. Ornamentation around the roof line and windows. And that house has actually been noted in an architectural book dealing with book homes or catalog homes. But in 1882, the state bought their property, bought their farm and the house to fulfill legislation that created the first agricultural experiment station in the state. The station was to provide farmers with the latest scientific information, at least scientific for 1882, and the station was started at that point. The house was then used as occasionally for housing the director, but actually more of administrative building and the ongoing research activities. It remained in the control of the state ever since. By 1970, the building was no longer really needed. Some new structures had gone up, and it had served its time. And the station, at this time now, the station was owned or operated by Cornell University. although it was on the what we call the statutory side of Cornell. Cornell is partly state-funded, partly private. This remained as a state-funded side of the College of Agriculture, and it was it was essentially turned over by an arrangement, an agreement to New York State Parks. And let's note that New York State, the name is New York State Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Hmm. Parks then was commissioned to create it as a, or continue its use as a historic site. And they made several attempts to do that. There are very few historic sites in the Finger Lakes region. Right now, there is only Ganondagan and Sonnenberg. And so there was pressure from the state to actually create more historic sites. But this cyclic effect of trying to do something, then not succeeding, trying again, not succeeding, a lot of it tied into budgets, state budgets. And through the 70s and 80s and 90s, there certainly were cycles of the state budget. Good years, bad years. By 2017, they had made the decision that the building now was falling into disrepair. When it was turned over from Cornell, or the state, state SUNY system, the building was in good shape. But there was not the continuous and necessary maintenance needed for the building, and it started showing its wear. We then felt that it was important to try to do something. There, I should point out there were additional efforts during that time period to utilize the building more as a science education center or a hall of science that featured agriculture and food. But Parks ultimately made the decision that it was going to need to destroy the building, to tear it down. And we talk about these last-minute efforts. An announcement was made on a Friday that the following week the building would come down.
When was this?
This was in this year, 2018.
So earlier this year. So what's the status now?
Well, we raised a bit of hell.
After all of this big, long lead-up, you're the hellraiser.
It's
great.
You know, and I was, I have to admit, I was a partial participant. I spent my career as a professor there. I served 14 years in administration. So we had this on our radar that something needed to be done with Parrott Hall. And in fact, we had a SUNY-funded master plan developed in the early 2000s. That identified Parrott Hall as something that needed to stay there, and we would turn that into the administration building. Administration shared a building with meeting rooms and our library, and the library was expanding at that point, needed more space, and as a result of the master plan, they said, look, take Parrott Hall, put your administrative offices in there, and really do it right. Didn't happen. And so we were left with this dire state. Now, the Friends of Parrott Hall had actually gone into operation in 2017. We saw it coming. We just were a bit blindsided by the decision suddenly.
But how, Bob, if they said on a Friday, we're going to tear this thing down next week, is this the proverbial we're going to stand in front of that wrecking ball moment? I mean, how did this happen?
I think that, Bob's right. We sort of did raise the hell, right? I mean, I think that at that point, a dialogue was created with New York State. A serious dialogue was created with New York State. And since that time, we are working as a coalition, including the Friends of Parrott Hall, the Landmark Society, the Preservation Exactly. League of New York State, is working very closely with New York State in crafting a licensing agreement by which the coalition will work to raise the money to stabilize the structure and then also undertake a feasibility study within that time frame to determine a use for the building.
Okay. How hopeful are you that this is going to work out, Bob?
We're putting a lot of our eggs in the announcement within the next few months, whether we were successful in getting funding from through the regional economic development programs, but the Environmental Protection Fund run out of parks. And if so, then with the coalition, we will, as Wayne said, do the initial stabilization. We will also relook at a feasibility study and trying to determine best use for that building. I personally feel that it is still needed as a visitors and education center for the experiment station.
Is that the best case scenario that you see?
There are others, but in my mind, that's best case. But I'm holding until the feasibility study is really done.
Okay. And then a year from now, is it possible we're sitting here talking about how that once again they decided to throw it in with the iceberg and the Titanic?
I certainly hope not. And I think that we
have... But what do you think?
Have,
do you expect it to be to survive this now?
Yes.
You do?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, but I fully recognize that the building could be demolished as well.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where it's certainly not a fixed fate, but there's a lot of different directions this one could go. It's why they choose sites like Parrot Hall in the city of Geneva for their Five to Revive list, and it's landmarksociety.org. I know they appreciate efforts like yours, Bob. I mean, this is every year we meet people like Bob who have put in a lot of personal time and effort to try to stop change like this that happens, that seems kind of quickly, but you guys clearly understood a year ago. That
well, I'd say, you know, without the aid of Landmark Society and the Preservation League, you know, these are the folks that really know what buttons to push, if necessary, where to go for funding. And the city of Geneva has also been extremely helpful. So without the coalition, we'd not be talking about it today.
All right. Well, if you're listening on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio all across the region, there's a number of other sites. And let's just hit the last two on the list before we go, because it's already 1:53. All right. So also on the list of Five to Revive, let's go out to Seneca County, the town of Seneca Falls, the former National Yeast Company and Iroquois Motor Car Factory. Caitlin Mivas, tell us about that one.
Yes. So it's a three-story brick industrial building with great character, big airy windows that would make perfect space for, you know, mixed use, artist studios, residential, office, you name it. And it's right on the 5 and 20 corridor just outside of downtown Seneca Falls. So it's an important historic corridor in the community. The current proposal is that the owner would like to demolish it so that another gas station / convenience store can be constructed in its place.
Another one of those?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how far along are we in terms of that kind of development?
So the owner has been working with the town of Seneca Falls to get permission to demolish the property. So at this point, the owner's been working through the town's preservation board. So that process, the board denied demolition, I believe, but you know, the owner is still trying to appeal that process. So
okay.
We're working to try and see if we can get a developer hooked up to present an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand putting gas stations where in places where there are none, like Henrietta. But for a place like Seneca Falls, I mean, it's a historic site there. I guess we'll see. So that's one to follow. Are you optimistic on that one, Caitlin?
That's one that could really go either way.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I'm 50-50 on that one.
All right, last one on the list is the Village of Holly down out in Orleans County. Odd Fellows Hall. What is Odd Fellows Hall?
So this is just this is right in the center of downtown Holly, which we've worked on with in the past with the Holly High School that's now on a better track. And this is really the largest kind of anchor corner building in the downtown commercial core that was originally an Odd Fellows Hall. It's been vacant for a number of years. The village wants their local development corporation to be able to take ownership of it. It's currently owned by an out-of-state owner who bought it for like $500 in an online auction. So
wow.
Those often aren't the best property owners. So the village is working to get control of the property. It's you know, got some bricks that are falling off of it. But I'm optimistic on that one if we can help the village out, get it on a better path.
And Evan, this is a great example where we're proud that the Five to Revive is that catalytic influence. So mm-hmm. Holly High School, which is located not far from this site, is currently in construction. And our Five to Revive committee specifically saw this resource as an opportunity to build upon the success of Holly High School.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting about looking at the list that you guys put together every year. It's not just in what you would call sort of historic Rochester or city neighborhoods. You've gone to suburbs, you've gone to villages, you go all across the region, and that's something that they've been doing every year. Penyan, Cattaraugus County, I mean, they go far and wide, and you can see what they are have put together for this year's list at landmarksociety.org and in past year's list. So Rochester's Aqueduct is on the list, the Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School campus, the former National Yeast Company and Iroquois Motor Car Factory, Oddfellows Hall in Holly, and Parrot Hall in the city of Geneva. And this will be very interesting a year from now to see the state of these here. I want to thank our guests for coming in and telling us about these. And so thanks for coming all the way in, Bob Seem, from Geneva, and good luck to you on the continuing work there. We appreciate the time.
Thanks so much.
Our thanks to Monica McCullough, who is working, of course, on the Colgate Divinity School neighborhood, and she is the president and founder of MM Development Advisors. Nice having you. Thank you for being back here.
Thank you.
And you guys are moving in, you said, in the spring to your new digs at the Landmark Society, Wayne and Caitlin.
We are. Warner Castle in the spring.
Warner Castle. So really cool that you're going to have a home that is perfectly fitting to the work that you're doing. Always nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
I want to thank John Andrus, the engineer. Tiana Magnon is gracing us with her presence here, our former colleague at WXXI and one of the great journalists in this town, and it's always nice to work with her. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a lovely afternoon wherever you are, and we'll talk to you Thursday on member-supported public radio.